It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Barbara Ehrenreich is many things. She's a journalist, an activist, and a best-selling author of 21 books. She's best known for exposing what it's like to try to get by when you're earning minimum wage in America in the book Nickeled and Dimed. She has her PhD in cell biology, and she's also a woman in her 70s. In her latest book, Natural Causes, she turns her unflinching gaze on the end of life. She's visiting the University of Iowa campus today to receive the 2019 Krauss Essay Prize, awarded each year by the University of Iowa's Nonfiction Writing Program. The award ceremony is tonight at 7:30 in the Senate Chamber of the Old Capitol Building in Iowa City and is free and open to the public. And she is here with me now. Barbara, welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here. And in reading Natural Causes, you start us off with a realization that you had where you decide that you no longer want to jump through the hoops created by our medical system. Can you tell me, you call it a midlife revolt. Can you tell me what was going through your head, what you decided for yourself?
Well, I began to see the trend when I was, I guess, around 50. You are expected, if you have health insurance, to come in for more and more tests and screenings, mammograms. I don't even know what all the things are. And being a naturally suspicious sort of person, I would question them. Say, you know, what are you going to find? And if you find it, what are you going to do about it? Is there anything can be done? You know, there's no point looking for things that are probably incurable. So it started, I think, for me with, what is it they want women to do? Bone density scans. You're probably too young to have been.
Just a little bit.
Huh?
I'm just a little bit too young. That's coming.
Okay, it's coming. So I said, you know, well, what will you find out? Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see if your bones are fragile. And saying, well, okay. So I, you know, did a little research. I was very skeptical, but I went through it. And guess what? I have a disease. It's called osteopenia. This is a newly invented disease, you know, in the last 10, 20 years. And it means your bones are old. Well, naturally. I'm old.
Right.
Every woman over 35 has some degree of osteopenia. And the doctor said, there's a pill I could take. Well, it didn't take me much research to find out that that pill had itself been implicated in increased risk of bone fractures. So I said, no. What have we done here, you know? In addition to helping support the medical industrial complex. So it started like that. But with every test that would come along, I would Google. And it's very easy to Google this. Just put in the name of the test and then next to it the word controversy. And you will find out what the debate is among doctors and scientists. And was enough to turn me off most of these things.
Well, this is a sort of a change of approach for you, not your skepticism. That's a lifelong that's, trait.
Yeah.
But you have embraced preventative medicine throughout much of your life. So what was the change, not just in looking at some of the tests and saying, hey, I don't see that this is scientifically based and, you know, there are risks of false positives and maybe the risks of that are bigger than, you know, the risk of not knowing that something's happening. But it was also a change in philosophy. You reached a line of demarcation in your own life. Tell me more about that.
Well, to put it very bluntly, I realized I was old enough to die. Over 70, certainly by that time. And I don't mean that we come with expiration dates on us, you know, that there's a fated time to die. but that I mean something very practical. If you look at obituaries in the newspaper, and if the deceased is, you know, over a certain age, there's not going to be a call for an investigation. You know, there's not going to be a lot of mystery. They'll likely say died of natural causes. And I realized in my obituary, there probably will not be a call for an investigation. 78-year-old woman dies, big deal, you know. So I thought, actually kind of relieved by that. Like, so many of my friends, and you may see the same thing, become at a certain age obsessed, the age now being down to about 21, with what they eat, whether they get the right amount of exercise. You know, they are monitoring their health, perhaps with devices. They are curating their meals to get the right amount of, you know, all the antioxidants and whatever it is they're looking for. And I just felt like, you know, enough of that.
I want to reiterate that this is not a rejection of science-based evidence for you. You are a very scientific person. You have your PhD in cell biology. So, I mean, in many cases, I suspect you know more than the people who are providing the healthcare that you were a part of, as far as what some of the things that they're saying mean. So you have done a great deal of reporting about our medical system, about healthcare. Do you think there's something about the healthcare that is provided to older Americans that takes a step away from evidence-based care?
Oh, yes. I mean, the fact that we even speak of evidence-based medicine, what's the alternative? You know, intuition? Based medicine or mystically inspired medicine. No, this is what it should all be. I mean, medicine gets its credibility entirely from its claim to having scientific roots. And when you start, you know, fudging that, when you start saying, things that are manifestly not true, then it shouldn't be called medicine anymore. It becomes more like a ritual. And I think for a lot of us, probably especially older Americans, it is a ritual. I got a clean bill of health from my doctor. You know, it's as if we've been blessed by some kind of, a spiritual figure. We're not thinking at all scientifically about what that might mean.
And there's even, you write about some of the evidence that has been uncovered in different research studies that the power of these medical rituals may be as strong or stronger than some of the medicine that we receive. People have expectations for what's going to happen to them when they go into the doctor's office, right?
Yeah. And this is very frustrating to me, because even when some test or procedure has been invalidated scientifically, a lot of people will continue to insist on having it. And I quote doctors who are frustrated by this, but said they'll say, you know, they told their older patient, no, you don't need that anymore. And the older patient feels like they're being cast off.
Right. And
no,
actually, in one case that you cited, filed a complaint. I'm going to get you in trouble for not giving me this test, right?
Yeah. And my attitude is exactly the opposite. And why I had to get a new, you know, internist, general practitioner type guy or gal. I said, I will come to you when something is bothering me, you know, hurting or bleeding or swelling or whatever, but you are not to go looking for things just for the hell of it.
No. So when you made this decision, you are a cancer survivor. And of course, as a cancer survivor, there are even more of these regular tests that doctors want you to have to make sure that your cancer is not coming back. And I mean, there are lots and lots of hoops to jump through. How did the people in your life who love you react to this? Did it scare them to have you say, I'm not going to do that stuff anymore?
No. Maybe because I just bullied them. I don't know. No, I guess for me, like the breaking point with breast cancer was you're supposed to have these annual or even every 6 months mammograms to see if it's recurring. And the last one I had was, quote, a bad mammogram. That's how it was conveyed to me. The doctor who had ordered it was out of the country. There was nobody to turn to. And I got pretty panicky for a while. Then finally it was revealed that this was not a, quote, bad mammogram. It was an error caused by the, it was a false positive because of the new kind of mammography they were using, which is, you know, ultra fine grained. And the whole thing, you know, my weeks of anxiety had been for nothing. And I said, okay, enough. It's not worth it.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I am talking with Barbara Ehrenreich. Her most recent book is called Natural Causes, An Epidemic of Wellness, The Certainty of Dying and Killing Ourselves to Live Longer. We will continue our conversation coming up after this break. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Barbara Ehrenreich. Her most recent book is Natural Causes, An Epidemic of Wellness, The Certainty of Dying and Killing Ourselves to Live Longer. She's probably best known for her best-selling book, Nickeled and Dimed, where she exposed what it's like to try to get by when you're earning minimum wage in America. And in this book, she takes an unflinching look at the end of life. She's in Iowa today to receive the 2019 Krauss Essay Prize, awarded each year by the University of Iowa's nonfiction writing program. And the award ceremony is tonight at 7:30 in the Senate Chamber of the Old Capitol Building in Iowa City. It is free and open to the public. And Barbara, before the break, we were talking about what you call your midlife revolt, where you decided that you no longer wanted to participate in some of the hoops that we need to jump through or that we're asked to jump through as we age in America. And you also wrote about some of your experience in healthcare in the past. You've written about this in other places as well. But you talk about when you gave birth to your first child, how that was such a galvanizing moment for you and maybe the moment where you truly became a feminist. Tell us about that experience.
Well, it was the final examination, the big deal at the end of your pregnancy. You see, I was a clinic patient. I didn't have a private doctor. And you got to see then the head gynecologist, obstetrician in the department. And he completed his exam, his pelvic exam, and I asked a question. I said, the cervix beginning to be effaced,
right?
Be effaced, because that's a sign.
Part of the process
the
of birth, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and he didn't look at me. He looked at the nurse in the room, and he said, "How did a nice girl like this ever learn to talk like that?" Now, at this moment, I had a newly earned PhD in biology. I realized that didn't matter. that I was like nothing to him. I was not supposed to have a conscious mind. I was not supposed to be educated or articulate or anything like that. It was that, that's really when I realized how much things were tilted against women.
Well, and you write a lot in this book about the kinds of care that women have received over the decades, and how for so long, I mean, they were shut out of even an understanding about their own bodies that was considered to be the realm of the doctors and their husbands. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about my own personal experience. I think I'm about the age of your children, and how I really felt empowered in giving birth, in, you know, the kinds of reading that I could do, the kind of understanding that I had, and then the kind of birth that I could ask for. And then I was thinking about what we know about maternal mortality rates in the United States and the breakdown by race. And I was thinking about the amount of privilege that I brought to that moment, how really we've seen this divide in our country grow. A woman like me, an educated white woman, can walk in and ask for the kind of birth experience that she wants. But so many women are not empowered in that way. Do you, in so many ways, we have taken big strides forward, but then in so many ways, we haven't. When you look at the healthcare industry today, what should we learn? What can we see?
Well, we see a strange, I would say, misallocation of resources overall. A tremendous amount of medical resources, and I mean the human part and the heavy equipment part and everything else, are aimed at the relatively wealthy and relatively old people. Very little attention to those who don't fit into those categories, especially if they're people of color. So there's this shocking fact that in the United States, maternal mortality, the deaths of women around the time of childbirth, it's going up, and it's always been going down bit by bit. And it's been going down in other countries, too. Here, zoom up. And what this means is a lot of black women in particular are somehow not getting appropriate care. And it's sort of a mystery exactly how that works. But there is, you know, I think it's a misallocation, that there ought to be more research on that and less concern about constantly testing and retesting some minor smudge on somebody's CT scan.
You write a lot about how it's not necessarily about race, it's about poverty. The background that people come from completely changes the kind of care that they're going to receive in our medical system today.
Well, I think this, in the case of the maternal mortality, it is very clearly a problem of race too, because wealthier black women, higher income black women, also have a difference from white women. So there's something else going on. It does have to do with race. But why aren't we researching that? Why aren't we finding out what it is and how it can be circumvented?
I saw something posted from a medical conference just the other day, trying to change that conversation, talking about how it's actually not race, it's racism, you know, that we need to insert in that, because there's no biological basis for women and children suffering at higher rates because of their race, that it's because of the infrastructure that we have in this country, the systemic racism, which is an interesting way to change that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
In your book, you write a lot about what you know about what is actually going on inside our bodies. You spend a lot of time talking to the readers as a cell biologist, explaining what's happening in the body. And you get pretty deep in the science, although you tell us that you're not going nearly as deep as maybe scientists would like us to go. What do you want your readers to understand about our body? Why is thinking about our cells important?
Well, we put such emphasis on our culture, in our culture, on controlling our bodies. We seem to imagine that if we eat the right foods and, do meditation and, various other practices, we can make ourselves more or less perfect, because the body is basically a self-adjusting machine, wants to be perfect. But what I'm trying to get across here is no, the body is not one big, happy, harmonious system. It's a whole lot of little living things crowded in together, as little living things are cells. Now, they cells, most of the time, are doing what they're told by the brain, by central command in the brain. But they can also do their own things. And this was to me the biggest shock in my research for this, is that it's now recognized that cells have a kind of free will. And I put, a lot of quote marks around that. But I think that's what it amounts to. That scientists now talk about cellular decision making. A cell can, quote, decide to go cancerous. Now, that you may think of as a figure of speech, whatever. Once it's decided to become a tumor cell, it can then, quote, decide to infiltrate other parts of the body or not. These are not things we control with our brains. And we have to understand we are not just one harmonious, beautifully functioning machine. We are, a collection of different beings doing sometimes their own things.
I'm talking with Barbara Ehrenreich. Her most recent book is Natural Causes, An Epidemic of Wellness, The Certainty of Dying and Killing Ourselves to Live Longer. You are welcome to join our conversation, 866-780-9100. How has growing older changed the way you think about your mortality? How has it changed the way that you think about healthcare? You can call us. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Again, the number is 866-780-9100. And Barbara, you mentioned some of the things that we will do to live longer, and you write a lot about the things that we will do to live longer in our culture. And it's interesting to try to take a sort of an outsider perspective. We all live in this culture. We all get these messages about fitness, about our diet, about all of the things that we should be doing on a regular basis. But you point out that a lot of those recommendations, again, don't have a lot to do with science.
With what?
Science. With what
science.
I actually know.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the claims made for some of the more new age forms of intervention in your health are often based on nothing at all. And then it also turns out when the things that are presented as fully scientific, if you look at the research behind them, they're not. So, the first thing is to be skeptical about all this. And why is that important? Well, as you mentioned yourself, you could get false positives from some of these things, and you can get bad results from things that are supposed to work out wonderfully. But also, this is an important point. You don't want to be wasting your time. The older I get, the less I want to waste time, the less time I have to waste, right? So I don't want to spend my remaining years in usually windowless doctor's waiting rooms or driving from one appointment to another or something like that. And really, in this society where we mostly insure the elderly, it's as if old people are encouraged that that's the way they spend their final years, going from medical appointment to medical appointment.
I'm sure there are some people listening to you say that and thinking, this is incredibly dangerous for her to say this at all, because so many people need medical care. And then when you're an older person, having the kind of insurance, having Medicare coverage, makes you feel more secure. And you're not saying that we need to take that away from people, right?
No, but I think we should question the allocation of medical resources. Yes, there should be Medicare for all, but, you know, not just for the elderly. It's simple, but I'm not taking away from anybody. In fact, we could probably, there's so many ways we could reduce medical costs in this country, like the cost of drugs. You know, if you compare to, say, Canada or Mexico, and the cost of very commonly prescribed drugs, that's a ridiculous cost. It's sheer profit. And similar, there's other similar things that could be considered waste. But also, I think a lot of this screening of people who are quite elderly, when I hear about, and I did write about this, a 100-year-old woman having a mammogram, I think, what? Why? If she is found to have breast cancer in some phase, is she now going to spend what is probably the last year of her life in chemotherapy? No. Not if she's thinking, clearly.
But a lot of people will do anything to extend their lives. And you write about that as well. People who you love, who you've watched, do anything to extend their lives. This has to be a personal choice. I mean, how have people responded to this idea? Do some people get upset?
No, I think some people agree and some people will do anything. But I think the question is that more and more people are asking is, what kind of life am I extending? Do we want to extend a life that is, you know, sustained by machinery, by breathing devices and all sorts of things? No, I don't. I think, you know, what we're getting here is the terror of death. Why is that there? So many people, it beats me. I'm not a religious person, but that so many people believe that there's something wonderful coming after their death. Well, why not leap into it, you know? I don't understand.
You write a lot about our human quest for immortality. And, you know, it's something that you don't just see in older people. Of course, you see it in a lot of young people as well. I mean, we talked about the fitness crazes and you know, so many different diets and exercise programs are touted as ways to not only stay healthy, but to reverse the effects of aging on the body. And you focus in on Silicon Valley as a place where there's this obsession with the idea of living longer and finding that key, coming up with that solution to help you do it. Why Silicon Valley? What do you see there that's so unusual?
Well, if you are a Silicon Valley billionaire, you know you are one of the richest and smartest people in the world. So why should you die? You know, what an annoyance. So
why do you have to be like everybody else, right?
Yeah, you don't have to be at least but like anybody else. So you find there's a kind of a cult, immortalism in Silicon Valley. A lot of money is being poured into research to extend life. And some of the individuals, like Ray Kurzweil, who are best known for popular writing about technology, they devote their lives to studying the minute amounts of this and that nutrient they absorb and how to make themselves live longer.
So you can live longer, but you're going to spend all your time doing that.
Right.
And not a lot of evidence that it's working yet either. All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest is Barbara Ehrenreich. She is the author of Natural Causes, An Epidemic of Wellness, The Certainty of Dying, and Killing Ourselves to Live Longer. She's in Iowa City today to receive the 2019 Krauss Essay Prize Award. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest this hour is Barbara Ehrenreich. Her most recent book is Natural Causes, An Epidemic of Wellness, The Certainty of Dying and Killing Ourselves to Live Longer. In the book, she takes an unflinching look at the end of life. And Barbara, before the break, we were talking about the degree that some people will go to try to extend their lives, not just healthcare later in life or healthcare in a situation where they're dealing with a very serious disease, but the things that people will do, people of means will do to try to ensure their immortality. You also sort of take the long view of that, talking about how humans conceive of themselves. And we have a really hard time accepting that we're kind of part of nature, right? I mean, you look at literature through the years, and we have a pretty inflated sense of what it means to be a human.
You put it very well. Yeah. I'm writing about that now. Narcissism, human narcissism, not just our president's narcissism or something, but you know, that what is it? We're so much better than every other species, and that our lives are so much more precious. We are part of that. I mean, in a way, in a sort of practical way, how this affects my ability to face death is that I have always seen my purpose in life to is being to help other people in some way, to make life better or to stop wars or to better distribute the wealth or something. And I know that I'm part of a long line of people who have worked for those things, usually in very different ways from the ways I have. But that line will continue after me. It's a long progression, I think, of people from religious people, labor people, all kinds of reformers and freedom fighters, and they go on. My death is incidental in that.
A lot of us don't want to think about our deaths as being incidental in any way, shape, or form. You write about what people will do to try to ensure some sense of immortality or focusing on their legacy. People who will spend, the last few years of their life starting a charitable foundation, investing in something that will carry their name forward. Now, obviously, a lot of great work gets done that way, but do you feel like that's the wrong approach?
Well, if it's all about preserving your name, face it, that's not going to make that. That's not a good goal. If it's about doing it for others, then you could do it in somebody else's name too.
Right? Do we know it's all about preserving our name, or are we fooling ourselves
a
little bit?
And it doesn't. No, I am not worried about legacies.
You, again, to return to your understanding of cell biology and sharing some of your scientific knowledge with your readers, you also feel like looking at life on the cellular level helps us understand better our place in nature. And for you, it also brings the way that nature interacts with each other, it brings it to life in a different way. You write about how in some ways science has looked at the world as if it's dead, not teeming with life. Tell me why you think that.
Yeah, and I should emphasize that I'm not trying to popularize science. I'm more of a science critic. And one, I think, deep assumption of Western science, which is pretty much what's all that's acknowledged as science, is that the body is inert, dead material. You know, once we can start talking about amino acids and nucleotides and so on, we're talking about non-living things, right? But what, you know, that drains from it is the very thing we're most interested in, is life. You know, is the possibility of something strange happening, of, you know, things not being utterly determined as if they were just being, you know, inert and being affected by gravity or something. And I think this is going to be a paradigmatic breakthrough in biology. It's already happened in physics to an extent, that we now understand that there are things we cannot understand about the behavior of particles, because they're going to do what they damn well please, you know, at a certain level. And the same with many things inside our bodies. And we have to become open to that, curious about that, and responsive to it.
In what way? How does becoming open and curious change our thinking?
Well, it certainly changes my thinking. If I think of myself not as a machine of smoothly interlocking parts, but if I think of myself as a city, hopefully a nation with some sort of laws, but maybe not, try it. It does put you more in the realm, as you put it, of being part of nature.
It also underscores this idea that I am inconsequential. And humans really battle against that. We want to think we're really, really important, each one of us. I mean, we have so much language around that.
Well, you are very important to me, because you are the person I am talking to right now and who I am thinking about right now. But I am not that important to me. I am just the observer here. Does that make any sense? I think of my own death differently than I think of other people's deaths. Other people's deaths are unthinkable and frightening and heartbreaking. My own death, poof. You know, I know the rest of the world will go on without me. And it will, I hope, be beautiful.
You've reached that point, but a lot of us haven't. So what do you think helped you reach that point?
Helped me?
Yeah.
So philosophically?
Philosophically.
Well, I think, what I said, the part of it is the feeling of being part of a tradition or a movement or a cause that goes through many, many generations and continues after mine. That's very important. The other is just that the beauty of the world somehow continues. And I'm so glad to have been able to witness some of it. But I know it will continue. And I hope that my grandchildren get to enjoy it.
We were talking earlier about your revolt against the kind of routine medical care that was recommended for a woman your age. We also touched on the fitness industry. And although you are not a fan of these fads and these promises of immortality and reversing your age, you have been a fitness buff quite a bit of your life. I mean, you do believe in exercise and fitness and taking care of your body. So what's the difference? Or maybe explain your approach. Why is it important to you if you're not thinking about extending your life?
Okay, you caught me, huh? You've revealed me. You've exposed me. I go to the gym. It's true. I do it because I like it. I feel better when I do it. It's not because if I go to the gym, you know, when I get home the day after tomorrow, I'll live 15 minutes longer. But it's because I'll just feel better. Now, I think I wish that, you know, there were more appealing ways to
feel better.
Though I understand there are a lot of gyms now that serve alcohol and cannabis, but probably not in Iowa.
All right. And I'm not sure you'll feel better in the same way once you get done at one of those gyms. But you have such a practical approach to life that is so appealing. I exercise because it makes me feel good. And then I enjoy life more because I feel good, because I'm healthy. I eat healthy for the most part because it makes me feel good, because it helps me enjoy life. And so many of these fitness recommendations are pushing us to do the same things, but for different reasons. So why
is it? But not all of them.
Yeah.
Like one subject that often comes up between me and people I know, people of my own, so educated, middle class people, are appalled that I put butter on things. Now, in Iowa, that should not be so appalling, I hope. But in
pretty
New York,
widely accepted here, yes.
Okay, good. In the Bay Area or somewhere, are you going to put butter on that? No, that I like butter. Butter is one reason for living. Or similarly, a glass of wine. I don't know what it's doing to my blood pressure or everything, but it's part of the reason for living. I want to optimize those things that are pleasurable. And now that I'm, quote, old enough to die, I can do it.
We have an email from Daniel, and he's agreeing with you. He says he has another example of the ridiculous behavior of the medical profession and aging. He says, at age 82, my grandmother ruptured her spleen. She'd been confined to a wheelchair with end-stage dementia for the previous 6 years. She was rushed to the hospital, where the surgeon pressured my father to agree to the surgery. He was treated like some kind of evil son who wouldn't do everything possible to keep his mother alive. Thankfully, he didn't cave. Also thankfully, my father had given instructions to all of his children that should he develop Alzheimer's and had to be institutionalized, all life-prolonging medications were to be discontinued. He passed away peacefully at age 83 after being in memory care for only 4 months, just what he wanted. From what Daniel's saying, it also makes me think about some articles that I've read recently talking about how doctors choose to die. And a lot of doctors will reject the kind of end of care intervention or end of life interventions that a lot of us will, you know.
I mentioned that in my book. You know, there are doctors who will have the letters DNR tattooed to their wrists. That means do not resuscitate. Why do they tattoo them to their wrists? Because they don't trust the hospital staff to respect their wishes otherwise.
We have a few minutes left here, and you write a lot about people making the transition from being afraid to die to accepting it. And you write about some different ways of making that transition, including using psychedelic drugs, which is an interesting bit of research that's been done lately. What are we learning about that?
Well, here I would recommend another book, Michael Pollan's new book, name eludes me suddenly. But he has written, he's done reporting about the research, especially going on in Johns Hopkins University Hospital, about using psilocybin to quote, cure, if I can use that word, the fear of death, as in people who know that they're going to die in 6 months with cancer or whatever has been diagnosed. And, you know, hallucinogenic drugs, psychedelic drugs do wonders for that.
Interesting. And the effect seems to last.
Yes.
Michael Pollan's book is How to Change Your Mind.
Ah, yes. Thank you.
So all right, if someone's listening right now in, well, really any of us at any age, but someone in later life who does fear death, who's uncomfortable with that, do you have a recommendation? Like how would you recommend someone start that journey to become at peace with the idea that, of course, it's going to happen?
Well, I would say you have to get out of yourself. Now, I'm not trying to be Zen here or anything like that, but not think of yourself, period, but not in such a bounded way. You know, I am part of this world. The world continues without me. And if I can get out of it and see the light and see the color and all that, and the beauty of the other humans and animals, it's different.
Being 78 years old yourself, how do you approach each day? I mean, knowing that you don't have that many days left.
Well, it's just a quantitative difference from when I was 13, say. I was about that age when I realized this all does come to an end. I was horrified. But yeah, no, what's the difference?
Does it make you appreciate things more, knowing that you may not be here all that much longer?
I don't know what to compare that with.
Like, just in your past, do you feel like you have a different perspective about the things that you enjoy, the things that you see and love in the world today?
You know, I feel if I were a real guru here, I would say, yes, I have reached a stage of enlightenment. But no, I get up, I do my work, you know, I interact with my family and friends and like everybody else.
So we only have about 30 seconds left, but you've already looked at the end of life. What's next for you?
I'm not having a baby, if that's what you're thinking. No. I'm going to become a grandma again.
Oh, that's exciting.
How's that? Be the third grandchild.
That is exciting.
Yeah.
Barbara Ehrenreich, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Barbara Ehrenreich, her most recent book is called Natural Causes, An Epidemic of Wellness, The Certainty of Dying, and Killing Ourselves to Live Longer. She's in Iowa City today to receive the 2019 Krauss Essay Prize, awarded each year by the University of Iowa's Nonfiction Writing Program. The award ceremony is this evening at 7:30 in the Senate Chamber of the Old Capitol Building in Iowa City, and that is free and open to the public. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.